Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Todd. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at a brand new case. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, like and follow the show. You can also leave a 5-star review. You can go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, along with exclusive content, just as my friends Channel and Anthony have done, as have my two biggest supporters, Debbie and Samantha. Y'all rock. Remember, that's tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Now, the crimes of Joseph Paul Franklin are varied and unique. As always, when covering a case of this type, I have to give a trigger warning to people. Joseph Paul Franklin was a white supremacist, and as such, all of his crimes were racially motivated. So if that's not something that you can handle, you may want to skip this episode or the next few episodes as we cover the things that Franklin did. Every case has to have a starting point, and while Franklin actually began committing his known crimes in the 1970s. We're going to actually start in 1980 with the most high-profile case that Franklin was involved in, and that is the attempted assassination of Vernon Jordan, a civil rights leader from Atlanta, Georgia. Now, Jordan had had a storied career as a lawyer, helping to desegregate the University of Georgia in the early 1960s, serving as the Georgia director of the NAACP, the executive director of the United Negro College Fund, now called the United Fund, and also the National Urban League. A lot of what Jordan seemed to preach was based around the idea of class and economic struggle. The racial tensions within the United States, along with what he saw as the growing number of racially motivated crimes occurring within the country. On May 28th of 1981, Vernon Jordan had traveled to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he checked into a Marriott hotel. He was in Fort Wayne to give a speech at the Urban League's annual Equal Opportunity Dinner, which is basically a fundraising affair. He was given room 180 in the Marriott, which is located on the first floor. Prior to giving his speech, Jordan had held a press conference where he largely criticized the Carter administration for what he termed as promise-making and a failure to keep said promises. After this, he attended a cocktail party where it's estimated he remained for roughly 45 minutes before heading to the fundraiser where Jordan gave his speech in front of a crowd of roughly 400 individuals. After this speech, Jordan said he hung around for a little while before heading back to his room where he contacted his wife Shirley and let her know how things went. After this, Jordan left his room, spoke to a number of people in the hotel, before eventually finding himself in the hotel bar called Piper's Glen Room. Now, it's at this bar that he meets a woman by the name of Martha Coleman. It needs to be pointed out that Martha Coleman was a white woman, whereas Jordan was obviously a black male. Much speculation has been put on this meeting, with some feeling that Jordan was actually fucking around on his wife with Coleman, as after spending some time at the bar, the two of them drove to Coleman's home, where she said they had coffee and nothing more. I'm going to point out, I have found no evidence to indicate that anything other than casual conversation took place between Coleman and Jordan. Now, during the roughly half-hour drive back to the hotel, according to both Coleman and Jordan, they stopped at a red light that was roughly half a mile from the Marriott Hotel. At this red light, they encountered a car which was filled with three white youths who began making racially disparaging comments to Coleman and Jordan. Jordan later stated, quote, "They continued on and I thought nothing of the episode. This was Indiana. It was all very familiar to me. I had driven around the state as a college student by myself or with friends, black and white, and was always comfortable doing so. When the light changes, the car with the white youths speeds away to a nearby fast food restaurant, with Coleman and Jordan arriving at the hotel at roughly 2 a.m. Coleman drives her car around to the side of the hotel, which is closer to Jordan's hotel room, at which point Vernon Jordan exits his vehicle. Both Jordan and Coleman stated that almost instantaneously of Jordan exiting Coleman's vehicle, they heard what sounded like a thunderclap. What happened was Vernon Jordan was walking behind Coleman's car. He was struck in the back with a bullet and immediately knew that something was wrong as the bullet lifted him up and threw him. Coleman stated that she saw Jordan get thrown, go to the ground. She runs out of the car and Jordan is screaming, "I've been shot, call the police." So she runs inside of the hotel so that an ambulance and police can be called. Now, Coleman's later going to state that she heard multiple shots, including glass breaking from her car window. Others who were ear and eyewitnesses to the shooting stated that they only heard a single shot. One witness who was on the fifth floor stated that he heard what sounded like an M80 going off, and it was so loud that it actually made him get out of bed and look out the window, at which point he saw Jordan lying against the back of the car screaming for help because someone had shot him. Jordan would later state, quote, "As I lay there on the concrete, I thought of my trip to Houston the next morning, which was a crazy notion under the circumstances. I knew that people were looking down on me from their windows, could see what had happened, but were afraid to come down in case the shooter was still there. So I lay there alone on the pavement all the while with a vivid sense that people were watching me from above." Jordan would later state that the wound he had received, which had hit him in the lower back and then exited out his chest, was, quote, indescribable beyond all measure of pain. What Vernon Jordan didn't know at this point was that only a part of a slug had entered him. The shooter had been over in a grassy knoll-type triangle from an off-ramp to the highway and had shot him from a sniper's position with a 30-06, intending to kill him by shooting him in the spine and severing his spine. However, there was a signpost for a street sign in the way, and the bullet struck this on its way to Jordan, entering to the side of his spine and shattering inside of him into his intestines and other vital organs. So Jordan is in an extremely bad way at this point. He's lying on the ground, but he knows that if he loses consciousness, he is most certainly going to die. An ambulance ends up arriving, taking Jordan to the hospital, where something of an argument ensues when the head surgeon demands that a African-American surgeon be the only one to operate on Jordan, which, given the circumstances, I'm sorry, but to me that is absolutely fucking ludicrous. The individual with the best qualifications or the individual who is next in line to operate should be the one to conduct an operation. That should have nothing to do with race, but that's my opinion. Jordan does end up living, although he has multiple operations and nearly dies numerous times. Almost immediately, the police are on the scene. They start looking around for evidence, and they find it across the street from the hotel in this grassy knoll that I described to you, where the grass seemed to be matted down. One of the officers on scene actually laid down in this grass and stated that they had a clear view of both the hotel where Jordan was shot as well as Jordan's hotel room. Because of Jordan's high-profile nature, the federal government takes note of this assassination attempt and immediately suspects that someone had been attempting to deprive Vernon Jordan of his civil liberties, which is a federal offense. And it's at this point that the FBI becomes involved. As the head of the FBI would later state, they really had no jurisdiction over this case. It was simply an assassination attempt. They had no motive. They did not even know if the person who had shot at Coleman had done so because of his race. So to get around all of these roadblocks and get themselves involved, the FBI decided that this individual was most likely threatening to intimidate or attempting to murder an individual, but that had been using the highway system, which is actually a federal offense, thereby allowing the FBI to become involved in investigating this crime. Scouring the scene, the FBI finds the spent cartridge from a 30-06 near where they assume the shooter had been lying. They also find the rest of the bullet that had hit Vernon Jordan lying in the crack of the sidewalk out in front of the hotel. They immediately begin looking for suspects to this assassination attempt, although at this point they don't know it's an attempt, as there's a very real belief that Vernon Jordan is actually going to die from the wounds that he suffered. Now, eventually, roughly 40 FBI agents are going to end up getting assigned to this case. And they're going to begin investigating the attempted assassination as though it was a conspiracy. In this context, meaning a group of individuals who conspired together to commit the murder of Vernon Jordan. Now, by June 4th, an estimated 400 individuals are going to have been interviewed by both state, local, and federal authorities, and they end up with a treasure trove of white supremacist suspects. One of these is a 40-year-old man who is a welder from Graville, which is roughly 10 to 15 miles northeast of Fort Wayne. According to officials, they had reason to believe this man was responsible, as witnesses had placed him at the Marriott bar on May 28th, where he was observed making disparaging remarks concerning Vernon Jordan. But it was his actions on the day of May 30th that really brings this man to police attention. He is arrested while driving a motorcycle intoxicated, and upon arresting him, officers discovered that he has numerous rifles in his possession, none of which he has a license for, and one of which is a 30-06, the same weapon that police had already discerned had been used in this attempted assassination attempt. Officers question the man. He swears up and down that he had nothing to do with the crime and that he had in fact bought the guns the previous day at roughly 6 a.m. for $100. So basically he's saying he's bought these guns a few hours after Vernon Jordan was shot. Eventually, the police are going to conclude that this individual, in fact, had nothing to do with Vernon Jordan's attempted assassination, and that the guns had not been fired in a considerable length of time. Now, no word on whether or not the man got back his property, given the fact that they took them from him and went through the whole chore of ballistics testing, it's highly unlikely that he did. Police also established that this man had an alibi for the time of the shooting, as he was at home getting drunk. Another individual that the police looked into was John Larry Ray, who is the brother of Martin Luther King's assassin, James Earl Ray. At this point in time, John Larry Ray was a fugitive from justice that the police and eventually the U.S. Marshals were actively searching for. Given his brother's history, the police suspected that it was a very likely possibility that John had followed in his brother's footsteps and attempted to take out a leading voice in the civil rights movement. There were also questions as to whether or not the murder may in fact have been motivated by what the police sensed were infidelities on Vernon's part, as they suspected Vernon was most likely cheating on his wife at the time, and that this may have led to either an enraged husband or boyfriend, or an estranged husband or boyfriend taking a shot at Jordan in retaliation for what they theorized was a domestic issue. After being interviewed by police, Martha Coleman ends up retaining an attorney, which she said was the logical thing to do for her after having been with a prominent individual who was then shot, although police viewed this skeptically, as do I, to be honest. They know she is not a suspect. The police tell her she's not a suspect. Why do you need an attorney? In any event, The police state that Coleman is not forthcoming with information, that she is refusing to tell them about her current boyfriend or give an address for one, and that she is not answering questions. However, Coleman counters this by informing the press that she has, in fact, answered all of their questions, even going so far as to volunteer to be hypnotized in order to better recall the events leading up to the shooting. By the following Friday, however, police internally had decided that it was highly unlikely any form of sexual relationship between Martha Coleman and Vernon Jordan had led to the assassination attempt on Jordan, which really leaves them with few options. One, it could have been completely random, which, given Vernon Jordan's public stature, was highly unlikely. Two, it was an individual with a personal grudge against Jordan. Or three, this was a racially motivated attack, which seemed to be much more likely as the days passed. The FBI in their investigation begins to back away from the idea that this was a conspiracy of individuals, as they were unable to track anyone down within the white supremacist movement who knew anything about the shooting. And internally, they began to suspect that it was more likely than not a lone gunman who they, as of yet, knew nothing about. Martha Coleman ends up going and taking a lie detector test on June 6th, after which Martha Coleman goes into a period of hiding at the suggestion of the police, as they don't know if the individual who opened fire on Jordan is going to return and attempt to shoot her. Coleman's lie detector test was listed as being a pass, meaning that at least on the surface, the police have no reason to believe that Martha Coleman has anything to do with the failed assassination attempt. As the days and weeks pass, the police and federal authorities really have no idea who the man or men responsible for this failed attempt on Vernon Jordan's life might be. But more than that, they have very few avenues to explore. We've discussed white supremacist organizations on this show numerous times in the past. In fact, it appears that I am one of the few true crime podcasts that is actually willing to touch this very touchy subject. The media did not want to start speculating that white supremacists might be behind this attack. Initially, there was some rumor going around that this attack on Vernon Jordan was racially motivated, but they very quickly latched onto other avenues, whether this was a conscious decision on the part of various editors and reporters, or a subconscious one, is really a moot point. The fact of the matter remains that while President Jimmy Carter was stating that this was an assassination attempt, local and national media were really downplaying the possibility that this could in fact have been the work of white supremacists. And it's not unheard of for them to do this. There had been a lot of racially motivated violence across the country in the previous two decades, and oftentimes this led to further violence, either by citizens enraged by the actions of a group or an individual, or by other individuals becoming emboldened by the actions of others and going out and committing their own racially motivated crimes. This point in history is peppered with stories of racially motivated violence, be it sexual assaults, beatings, or murders, happening all throughout the southern and western United States. At this point in time, the Atlanta child murders are in full swing, and it's going to be almost another year before those cases are at least officially solved. And with those cases, there is a lot of speculation going on that these crimes are racially motivated. So for the media to not want to touch the racial aspect or the potential racial aspect of the assassination attempt on Vernon Jordan's life is really understandable, as while they have a duty to report on what is happening, there is also a fear that this assassination attempt might result in further bloodshed and property damage if individuals become enraged enough that they begin to riot, which happened numerous times again throughout the previous two decades, particularly in the wake of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Not only was the media publicly sidestepping that idea, but law enforcement was largely remaining tight-lipped, only saying that the possibility that this was a racially motivated attack has not been taken off the table, while internally they're growing increasingly more and more convinced that this is in fact the case. Unbeknownst to everyone at this point is that the man responsible for the assassination attempt of Vernon Jordan, John Paul Franklin, had become enraged at what he saw as the media's missing the point of the assassination. See, Franklin wanted to start a race war, something that many white supremacists that we have covered on this show have wanted to do. And because of their looking at the possibility that there was a domestic dispute that led to Jordan's shooting, Franklin, by his own admission, decided to quote-unquote turn up the heat and traveled to Cincinnati with the intention of shooting an interracial couple. To quote Jordan, June was the most prolific. Was the most prolific as far as murders go in that month. I committed 6 murders, a big chunk of all the ones that I eventually committed in the whole 3 years I committed right there in those 3 months, you know. Franklin believed that if he were to go and commit a series of obviously racially motivated murders in Cincinnati, Ohio, this would draw the attention of the media and lead them to the conclusion that someone was targeting blacks, and hopefully, in his mind, would lead to blacks retaliating, which would thus force whites to retaliate in kind and create a air of open warfare among the races. Further concerning this period of time, Franklin stated, quote, I was just getting very upset because the news media, the national news media, wasn't covering what I was doing. They were pretty well suppressing the news. I don't know, I guess they were afraid they'd start a race war or something. And that's what I was trying to do. I just decided to just turn up the heat a little bit, just start committing more killings, and just try to force them to get me publicity because they didn't want to publicize what I was doing. On June 8th of 1980, in the Bond Hill neighborhood of Cincinnati, at roughly 11 p.m. that evening, two cousins, 13-year-old Dante Evans Brown and 14-year-old Daryl Lane were out walking, intending to carry to Brothers 3 Carryout, where they wanted to buy candy. Now, why a 13 and 14-year-old were out at this time? The two cousins, along with their siblings, were spending the weekend at their grandmother's house. Their grandfather had fallen asleep, so Daryl and Dante decided that now would be the perfect time to sneak out. According to a later statement given to the police, as they were heading to the store, they encountered Linda Lane, who was Daryl's older sister. They asked her if she wanted to go with them. Linda declined and headed back towards the grandparents' house, with the two boys continuing on towards the store. Now, according to Linda, she went into the house and was changing her clothing when she heard what sounded like a car backfiring in the street. Another witness, 13-year-old Anthony Jones, would tell the police that he was outside and he saw the two boys coming out of a motel parking lot and walking northbound on Reading Road. Dante and Daryl were on the westbound side of the street, just beneath the railroad overpass. As the boys neared the store, Daryl is shot. Seeing this, Dante turns to flee and is shot in the back before another shot rings out and Daryl is shot once again. Daryl ends up being shot twice in the upper chest and in the right hip. Dante was hit in the back and also in the right knee. Obviously, both of these boys are in serious condition, with Daryl paralyzed and dying from the first shot, and Dante bleeding out in the street. Three passing motorists in a car saw both boys fall as well as heard the gunshots, while another individual heard the gunshots and realized immediately that whoever was shooting had a large caliber weapon. These gunshots also woke both boys' grandmother up, who, upon realizing that her grandsons had snuck out of the house dressed and went outside to see if she could find them, with her granddaughter Linda hot on her trails. Linda ends up reaching the scene of the shooting after her grandmother does, and in her own words, walked up on a scene of quote-unquote unspeakable horror. Grandmother was holding Daryl's hand, and she noticed that her brother had a dollar bill clutched in his free hand. So this is going on. The driver of the car, who saw the boys get shot, immediately flips a U-turn and heads back down the street to the police station, where she reports the shooting. Officer responds to the scene and attempts to perform emergency medical management on both of the boys, as well as radioing for backup and for an ambulance. Two officers arrive pretty quickly and they take Dante to the hospital. During the trip to the hospital, Dante recovers enough to inform the officers that he didn't see who had shot him. He only heard gunshots. Dante ends up lapsing into a coma upon reaching the hospital and dies 2 days later at 8:03 a.m. on June 11th. Daryl Lane was pronounced dead at the scene. He was officially pronounced dead at the hospital at 1:32 a.m. on the morning of June 9th. Very quickly, a crime scene is established, and officers begin fanning out, looking for anyone who may have seen or heard anything. a doctor on the scene noting the entry wounds on Daryl's body postulates that it's almost certain the shots had come from above, and with this in mind, they begin investigating the train trestle. They end up recovering 4 shell casings on the train trestle. These were 44 caliber Remington Mag Federal brand. It's later determined that the weapon used was a 44 caliber Ruger Magnum carbine rifle. Beyond a partial footprint in the soil and an empty beer can found near where they believe the sniper to have been positioned, police do not have a whole lot of information on which to go. Bond Hill, which is a integrated neighborhood, is extremely stunned by this senseless murder. So much so that parents decide to keep their children home, not allowing them to go outside, while the Cincinnati police form a task force in an attempt to try and determine who committed this heinous act and what their motives could be. However, unfortunately, the case very quickly goes cold, as there just isn't enough evidence or witnesses to point them in the right direction. In fact, one of the only witnesses who reports seeing anything weird worked at the Big Brother 3 convenience store. This man stated that on both June 7th and June 9th, a man with darkened skin and an afro had come into the store. He had waited on the man both times, but the man had left the area rather quickly. Police are really unable to come up with a sketch of what this man looked like, or even of his nationality, based on the description of the store clerk, and are left flummoxed as to the entire thing. What no one knew was that Joseph Paul Franklin, after shooting the two boys, had quickly fled the area, heading back to a motel he had in Florence, Kentucky, which is roughly 20 miles from Cincinnati, where, in his own words, he stayed for a few days, making certain that the police had no bead on him before destroying the weapon that he had used and getting rid of the parts. Something that's later going to become a bone of contention in the cases against Franklin, in that he insists until his dying day that every weapon he used in the commission of a crime was destroyed afterwards, and that he did not sell any of these weapons. However, law enforcement officials and numerous media accounts state that he would use the weapon and then sell it either at a gun show or to a white supremacist that he knew, in order to get funds to continue on with his murderous rampage. However, I have found no evidence to suggest that this was in fact the case, and Franklin's statements that he destroyed every weapon that he used in the commission of a crime seem to be borne out by the fact that no murder weapons have ever been found. Franklin would state years later that when he read about the shooting in the newspaper, he was stunned and surprised to learn that both boys had died, stating, quote, "I just considered that it was just wounded. I was a complete failure." Now, this man I'm talking about, Joseph Paul Franklin, he's exceedingly meticulous in his method of operation, his MO, in that he scours an area looking for a perfect sniper's perch to commit his crimes from thinking through every eventuality in the course of a crime, not only people coming upon him as he's preparing to commit the crime, but also law enforcement possibly becoming involved. And he believes that he is not leaving any sort of trail. However, Franklin is leaving a trail which is eventually going to be used to tie him to these crimes, although at this point in June of 1980, no one is aware of it. After getting to Kentucky and registering at the hotel, Franklin had taken out a number of ads in the newspaper looking to sell both a rifle as well as a guitar and amplifier. He ends up selling the guitar and amplifier to a woman who feels that something is off about Franklin, and because of this, she writes down the license plate number to his car, which is going to later be used to link Franklin to this motel and to having been in the area when both of these boys are murdered. He also goes to a nearby gun store where he sells this rifle, which I have to point out was not the rifle used in the commission of any of his crimes. And all of this is logged and registered, with the gun being sold in Columbus, Ohio, an area that Franklin had been to many times before, and which we're going to come back to in another episode. Now, after doing this, Franklin heads to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is up in the Appalachian Mountains, roughly 60 miles from Pittsburgh. Franklin had spent a considerable amount of time in Johnstown in the previous 3 years, and he knew the layout fairly well, which is something that he does quite often. He revisits a place to commit a crime or to get rid of incriminating evidence from a crime at an area that he has previously committed a crime at, and it's thought by some that this is kind of Franklin's way of reliving his crimes by going back to these areas where he has done various things, and that these areas constitute his quote-unquote territory. Now, in Johnstown, Franklin decides that since he failed to murder an interracial couple while he's in Cincinnati, he is going to make certain that he succeeds this time. On June 15th, 1980, Joseph Paul Franklin went to the Washington Street Bridge in Johnstown. He found a hillside roughly 55 yards from the bridge where he ends up making a perch and waited. According to Franklin, at some point a couple did pass by. However, he thought they may have spotted him. They were not interracial, so he pretended to write something down until the couple had left the area. He said that eventually, just after 11 p.m., he looked through the scope of his rifle and was surprised to discover that an interracial couple was making its way towards the bridge. The male, a 22-year-old black man by the name of Arthur Smothers, and his 16-year-old white girlfriend, Kathleen Makula. Now, regardless of what you believe in terms of interracial dating, my personal opinion, and many agree with me on this, there's no reason why, even in 1980, a 22-year-old man should have been dating a 16-year-old, but that's just a sidebar. In any event, Franklin stated that Arthur was wearing a ball cap of some type, while Makula, quote, looked a blonde-haired kind of a dumb-looking broad, goofy-looking. Now, Franklin later stated that at first he wasn't completely certain that the two were together, as they were walking separately, but as they started to cross the bridge, the two of them came together, and he was certain that this was an interracial couple. Now, to quote Franklin, he had learned, quote, "The black would usually run off first, and I wouldn't get a chance to get him. This is what I found out starting out, so I changed from then on and always shot the black guy first, because when she was standing there, she would always stay with him to try and help, but he would always want to run off when he was shot." Smothers ends up being shot first, collapsing from the sidewalk into a gutter, while Kathleen begins to frantically shout for help to any passing car. The next shot misses Kathleen, blasting a large chunk out of the concrete nearby her, which Franklin states immobilized her with terror. Quote, "She didn't even run, which is fortunate for me. I just racked the action and put it on her again, and this time I got her. She dropped right there, I racked the action one more time and shot again, and then one more time and shot her again." Franklin quickly exited the hill, getting down to his Chevy Nova and leaving the area. While out on the bridge, traffic had come to a complete standstill, and as Joseph Paul Franklin makes his way down to Washington, D.C., people in Johnstown are stunned by the brutality of the murders. And the news of the couple's murder completely rocked the area. They weren't used to this type of thing. And it was fairly certain almost from the get-go that this particular murder was in fact racially motivated. And while police were able to recover shells from the gun used from the hillside, they were unable to find any suspects. In fact, Franklin ends up never being charged with this particular murder. He does, however, admit to it later while he is in custody. But Joseph Paul Franklin's murder spree is not done. He is going to continue on with committing his various crimes after he leaves Washington, D.C. We know that he heads to Burlington, North Carolina, where he robs a bank, before going to Virginia Beach, which he stayed in for a few hours before deciding that it wasn't an area he needed to be in. According to Franklin, he headed to Kentucky from this point. However, a man later came forward stating that Franklin had bought a .30-06 from him on June 24th or 25th. The man had run an advertisement in a local paper and been contacted by an individual from a nearby town. He described the man as being roughly 6 foot tall with reddish shoulder-length hair and eyeglasses, the lenses of which one was considerably thicker than the other. The man would later describe the purchaser of this gun as being strange and unsmiling, stating that he was never able to get the man to smile during the course of his interactions with him. We do know, though, that by June 25th, Joseph Paul Franklin was in West Virginia. And somewhere while he is traversing Pocahontas County, he encounters two hitchhikers, 19-year-old Nancy Santamaro and 26-year-old Vicky Durian. Now, these three women were part of something that's known as the Rainbow Girls. Some websites describe the Rainbow Girls as being a counterculture movement. The reality is that they are an offshoot of the Masons. And I know this because I had a friend when I lived in California who was a Mason, and his daughters were both Rainbow Girls. Without getting too deeply into it, Rainbow Girls is basically like a youth organization for the children of Masons. They had been hitchhiking across the country with a friend of theirs who had decided to stay in Richmond, Virginia, while Nancy and Vicky continued on to a rainbow gathering in Monongahela National Forest. Now, according to Franklin, after he picked these young women up and they're driving, a conversation comes up and he eventually turns the topic to one of race, asking the girls what they thought of blacks. One of the girls apparently tells Franklin that she had dated a black male, which immediately sets him on the course of, I'm going to kill these two young girls. He also stated that the other girl informed him that she would date an African American if she found the man to be suitable as a partner. We know that prior to encountering Franklin, a man had seen the two girls at a convenience store on Route 219 outside of Lewisburg. We know this as the man was able to positively identify both of the girls from later pictures, and in fact he stated to police that one of them, Nancy, was wearing a red University of Iowa athletic department sweatshirt. They eventually end up in a place called Briar Knob, which is near Droop Mountain Battlefield State Park. According to Franklin, he informed both of the girls that he was going to rape them. He said that both girls became very antagonistic at this point, and he decided that it would not be possible to sexually assault one of them while subduing the other. So instead of committing a sexual assault, he removes a .44 caliber Magnum handgun. According to Franklin, quote, first words Vicky said was, oh my god. Second one didn't say anything. It was very quick. I shot the one in the front, one in the back, shot her again. I was so psyched up, I didn't hear the gunfire, really. Basically, Franklin shoots both of these girls, with Vicky having been shot twice in the head, and Nancy being shot once in the head and twice in the chest. Mind you, all of this happened, at least according to Franklin's account, inside of his car. After this, he pulled their bodies out and left them in the dirt. Franklin stated that as he was driving down the dirt road out of the area where he had just committed this murder, he passed a car, and realizing that the driver might be able to identify him, he turned his head and looked out the passenger side window until the car passed him. Again, according to Franklin, he then drove to Hicko, West Virginia, which was roughly 60 miles from the area he had committed the murder, and got rid of the girls' duffel bags. Investigators have really nothing to go on in the murders of Nancy and Vicky. They characterized the murders as being done execution style, stating that Nancy had powder burns on her chin. Police were unsure of the exact make of the bullets. They did state that they were reloads, which means that it was a used shell casing reloaded with a new head, firing pin, and gunpowder. They were unable to decide whether or not, however, if the weapon used was a revolver or a rifle. And while Franklin admitted to having committed these crimes, many speculate that it may, in fact, not have been him who committed them. However, given the details that he was able to provide and the fact that it does not appear that Franklin took claim for any murders which he did not commit, in all likelihood, he is in fact the man responsible for having murdered these two young girls. Which brings us to the end of this episode, with Joseph Paul Franklin having committed 6 murders in 3 different states, 1 attempted murder, and at least 1 bank robbery. However, Franklin is not done at this point, and law enforcement has no idea that he is operating or that he has been on this crime spree for at least 3 years, dating back to 1977, which is what we're going to start discussing next episode. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid.